pull up a squeaky chair. It's time for our once every 2 month meeting. I have my squeaky chair. I got the dog. Here he comes. You can hear him right now. I got the cat. I have my heater because I do this for free and I'm not going to be cold while I'm doing it. So apologies that you can hear it, but I don't care that much because my tushy will get cold. So I don't really have a whole lot to say before we start talking about today's case, which is Paula Sims, Robert and Paula Sims, more accurately. And I wanted to just quickly throw out a thank you. I didn't jot it down, but I think it's K-H-N-H-N-C, something like that, K-N-C-H-N-C. Thank you for your glowing review on Apple Podcasts, because I am kind of insecure about the name of this podcast. I feel like people don't understand unless they listen to the first episode, which, to be honest, I hope nobody ever does that, because that's punishment for your ears. So that was really nice, and I just really enjoyed all the nice things that you had to say, and thank you so much. So a little shameless request, like I do in almost every episode, if you guys want to do something really quick and helpful, you can always leave a review, and it doesn't have to be a great one. And if it's a bad one, then please just don't listen to this anymore. But if it's a medium one, because you have suggestions of what could make it better, I will gladly accept those. Not that I have a choice. I can't delete them or anything. Okay. let's see. This is going to be very, very informal. Let me tell you why as I take a sip of my coffee. Did you guys like that? I feel like I'm going to do an immersive podcast episode today. You know those YouTube videos where like a cat is purring on a witch's altar or something? Or like, personally, I've been listening to this one that is a post-apocalypse. Oh, fucking fuck. Should I put this on the blooper reel? Post-apocalyptic zombie scene. Because like, I don't know. I just really like the vibe. I'm sorry that I said that. I'm 36. I said vibe. But it's like, the fire is very good, crackly. It's just, it has like a really good tone. Holy shit, Megan. The point of this is that's what this podcast is going to be like. You're going to hear the cat. You're going to hear the heater. So just pretend that you're listening, watching to like one of those videos that really makes you feel like you're here. Okay? I lost like a big chunk of my notes on this case. So it's going to be pretty informal because I have a general outline of the things that I do, and then I just kind of wing it. So like, I'm extra winging it tonight. Okay, are we all clear? All right, let me switch into podcast mode. So Paula Marie Blue was born on May 29th, 1959 in La Plata, Missouri, to Nyleen and Orville Blue. La Plata was a small farming town. In 2020, the population, I think, was less than 1,300. Paula, was described as a shy tomboy. She liked baking, though, and would often take cookies to a neighbor, which I just thought was really cute. She was the youngest of three children, two older brothers named Randy, born in 1956, and Dennis, born in 1955. When Dennis was three, though, he contracted measles and really struggled with that. He had a lot of health issues. He was afflicted by seizures, and as a result of that, he lived at home with his parents through adulthood. Randy, though, was like pretty popular, handsome, you know, described as kind of like the all-American popular high school kid, jock type guy. He did tease Paula a lot, but spent a ton of time with her playing basketball, and she pretty much idolized him. Paula was a star athlete. She excelled in basketball, but as she entered her teenage years, she started hanging out with Randy and his friends a bit more. And one of her high school boyfriends said that he and Paula would drink and just smoke pot mainly, but when they could get it, they would also use LSD together. Sometimes Paula would take the seizure medications that were prescribed to Dennis as well. So just a little background on maybe like her mental state, but you know, this was like the 70s also, so I would imagine taking LSD probably was no big deal. she did steal insignificant items like candy, for example, just to see if she could get away with it. But many described her as not afraid to stand up for herself or her beliefs. Like, she was pretty outgoing in that sense. And she would go out and make extra money mowing lawns, you know, really didn't get in trouble at school, like, seemed pretty responsible, made some money for herself, probably spent her lawn money on LSD, I don't know. But the teachers all said that she was bright, she got good grades. There was really nothing to write home about overall. On April 10th, 1976, Randy and Paula were hanging out together when Randy crashed the car that they were both riding in, and he ended up dying at the scene. Paula did suffer facial injuries. She had surgery for injuries to her jaw as a result of the crash. And so as we get into this story more, we might wonder, you know, if there was anything going on in her cranium from this accident. Now, after Randy's death, Paula just never seemed happy again. She quit basketball. She became more quiet, withdrawn. She had less friends than she had kept before. And I got a lot of information from this book. I should kind of like give a disclaimer here. The book is called Precious Victims, and it was written by both a journalist. His name is Charles, I'm so sorry, I don't have his last name or the book up in front of me. I believe it's like Bosworth. I'm pretty sure that's what it is. And I will tell you guys for sure. And, you know, I'll put the book information in the show description. But the other author of the book was Don Weber, who is a prosecutor. So this story is like, you can probably figure out where we're going with it. And if you follow me on TikTok, you already know the end of the story. So, you know, this podcast is kind of just like more of a background about Paula and her husband and events leading up to larger events. But the reason I'm telling you about who wrote the book is because I don't know how just objective it was written. There is another book written by a former TV reporter. Her name's Audrey Becker, I believe. Again, I don't have that in front of me because I didn't plan on talking about that right now. But she talks to Paula, and, you know, I haven't read that one yet. So I do want to read that and kind of compare and see, like, what the tone of each of them are. I would assume there's probably some discrepancies because one book is coming from the prosecutor's point of view and the other is coming from Paula Sims' point of view. So anyway, I just wanted to like tell you guys that right now. I got a lot of information as far as facts and dates and things like that, but it did come from a book written by someone who was prosecuting this woman. So, that's what I was gonna say. She had like one or two friends in the book, they said. Like, you know, she always had kind of a group of friends before, but after the accident, she had just maybe one at a time or two at the most at a time. Something worth noting is that according to an FBI report, a highway patrol trooper investigating the crash says that he was told by a La Plata officer that he had found Randy and Paula in the car parked and engaged in a sex act. Now, the FBI could not confirm this report. They interviewed all the La Plata officers from 1975 through 1976, and no one claimed any knowledge of this incident. And the reason that I'm bringing that up is because it's reported, I think, more in depth in that book that I told you by Audrey Becker. What is that book called? That book is called Dying Dreams. In her book, I think it goes into more detail about some sexual abuse that Paula suffered at the hands of a grandfather beginning around age 7. He would do things like fondle her, expose himself. He would masturbate in her presence, threaten her with sexual assault. So, like, really not good stuff at all. And then growing up with a brother also doing some not good stuff, if that was true. This is all just hearsay because it was never confirmed, verified. And I, like I said, I haven't read this book, so I don't know if Paula talks about that in her book, or in this book, excuse me. I think it's only about the grandfather. So either one of those things alone would obviously cause psychological traumatic issues, but if it's happening with like two male members of her own family, I think that would be like a pretty profound impact, I would imagine, down the road. Now, about a month after Randy's death, the family moved from La Plata to, Orville, the father, he worked with Amoco Oil, and they had a Wood River refinery in Illinois. So they moved to a town called Cottage Hills nearby for Orville to work on this pipeline. And I think it was probably a good welcomed move for the family. Paula's father ended up arriving at the scene of the crash. So like, he was pretty good friends with an officer in town, and I believe that the officer told him about the crash and that it had been Paula, and, he heard from over the radio or however it happened, but Orville ended up at the scene and he's, relieved that Paula is fine. Mostly, like I said, she had some facial injuries and stuff, but she's relatively okay, but there's a body lying under a sheet, and Orville's like, whose body is that underneath the sheet? And it was his son, Randy. So I think getting out of just that area with those memories, probably a good thing. Now in Cottage Hills, Paula made a couple of friends, and one was named June. They graduated high school pretty quietly, and Paula went on to attend Lewis and Clark Community College for about a year. She took a key punch program. I'm assuming that's like maybe shorthand or some type of data entry. I didn't look it up, so sorry, that was before my time. And she didn't end up finishing the program, and she started working as a cashier at the National Food Store in Godfrey, Illinois. Shortly before meeting Robert, June says that a song was released by Queen that Paula told her she would name her first daughter after, Lorelei, because she did want children and she wanted a girl. This doesn't matter at all, what I'm about to tell you next. To be honest, it has no relevancy, but I cannot find a Queen song related in any way to Lorelei. Like, I can't find one titled Lorelei. I couldn't find any with the name Lorelei in the lyrics. Styx released a song titled Lorelei in like 1975 or 1976. So just wanted to tell you that in case you read that book. Don't even know why I was looking it up, but that's what I do. We're going to move on to Robert now. So Robert Eugene Sims was born on April 20th, 1952 in Carbondale, Illinois to Troy and Wilma Sims. He joined the Navy in 1972 and served most of his 3-year enlistment at a Brunswick, Maine naval station, which has since been permanently closed. I think 2009 was like the last activity they had, and it was permanently closed in 2010. So the Navy tells Robert that they didn't like his negative attitude about, like, I don't know, being in the Navy, I guess. They listed him as ineligible for reinstatement, citing like a negative. When Robert was 21, he met a 17-year-old girl while still in Maine and married her on July 5th, 1974. They moved back to Alton, Illinois, and Robert resumed his regular life where he had been working at a credit union. Most of his coworkers were women, and all of them, including his female supervisor, described him as, quote, just plain weird. In 1976, a woman whose desk was located next to Robert's really had like some weird harassment going on. Her sandwiches at lunch would be smashed, or she would find that pop had been poured into her desk drawers. And eventually it escalated to where her car had a vulgar word spray painted on the front door. She eventually ended up receiving a letter in the mail. Now, in this letter, there was a magazine picture of a naked woman, but her breasts and her genitals were removed out of the picture. Like, those were cut out. And then, just like in some type of bad movie, all the letters on, I was going to say letters in the letters, but that sounds strange. All of the words within the letter were created using cut out letters from a magazine. So, like, you cut out the letters from a magazine and then glue them to this piece of paper. You know what I'm saying? Are you getting the visual? Like I said, a really cheesy bad movie. But the words spelled, "This could happen to you." So that's terrifying. Like, imagine getting that in your mailbox. She began to experience hang-up calls for a couple of weeks, and she called the police, and they ended up putting a phone tap, and they found that 3 hang-up calls after installing this tap were from Robert's home. Now, his wife said that it was her, and she explains this by saying, "I found this phone number on his dresser, and I called because, you know, I'm mad and I'm a jealous wife." And I believe he had invited the woman over for dinner at their home, which seems weird because, like, why would you do that? I don't know if it's like a really menacing invitation or like what was going on. There wasn't a whole lot of detail about that, and I didn't look into it too far, but either way, super glad that she didn't go to dinner there. So the wife's like, nope, it was me. Nothing to do with Robert. And she was charged with disorderly conduct, but the charges were dismissed. Robert didn't face any charges at all. And a coworker said that she thinks that the wife took the rap for Robert. Everybody kind of thought that. The victim, everybody was like, yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Robert doing all of this, and his wife just said it was her. Now, after this all happened, he was given an ultimatum, like, you can quit or you can be fired, and he quit. Now, his wife told the FBI later that she had made the calls, but she wasn't sure if it was her idea or Robert's. But either way, it didn't matter. She would have done it regardless. So if Robert would have said, like, I suggest you make these phone calls, she would have done it. She did say that he was present during the time that she made some calls, but she's remained adamant even later, even after their divorce. Spoiler alert, they got divorced. She was like, I didn't take the blame for him. It was all me. After a short stint at a different credit union because of just issues with his general personality, he found steady work at the Jefferson Smurfit plant. It had been previously known as the Alton Boxboard Company. They were a paper products manufacturer, and I think that they employed like a lot of the locals in the Alton area. And at this employer, he was described as quick to anger, weird, kind of a recurring theme for Robert Sims is like, he's a weird dude. It's not a crime to be weird though, okay, as we know. He, again though, like took it a step further. Instead of just being weird and like pouring pop in people's desk drawers, he was putting used condoms and cockroaches in a coworker's sandwich, a female coworker's sandwich. So citing extreme and repeated mental cruelty on Robert's part, which I would have to say after learning that a human was putting condoms, used ones, and cockroaches in a sandwich, yeah, you have to be, that's like, I can't imagine what's going on in with your mental state. So you're absolutely going to be the most cruel to other human beings. Robert and his wife got divorced, like I said. But that's why they got divorced. So Robert laid pretty low after that, relatively. There was no major events. He had a small shoplifting charge in 1979 after he stole some tools from a hardware store. And he was arrested later when the truck he had left in was stopped. He pled guilty, paid a small fine, you know, whatever. Now, in 1979 or 1980, a cousin of June's introduced Paula to Robert. They attended a concert together, began dating, and they married in May of 1981. They rented a house in Cottage Hill for some time, and Robert would tell Paula about his horrible Vietnam flashbacks and his nightmares. I could see how one might mix up Maine with Vietnam, but Robert did. So if you remember just a few moments ago when I told you he just was at a naval station in Maine the majority of his 3-year tour, so I don't really know what was going on there, but that's what Paula told people later, is my poor husband and his poor PTSD. In December of 1983, Paula was fired from her grocery store job after her boss used a hidden camera to watch her discount groceries for her friends. Like a significant discount. We're talking like $200 worth of groceries down to 50. But that was okay because Robert was making a decent living and the couple bought a house in Brighton, Illinois in January of 1984. A short time later, June, remember Paula's friend, got a call and it was Paula telling her that she was pregnant. And June says that Paula was absolutely ecstatic. Like she was so pumped to be having a baby. So, you know, she had said earlier that she wanted kids, wanted a girl. Everything seemed great. And then she had a girl. Lorelai Marie Sims was born on June 5th, 1986. Now, neighbors of the Simses, Minnie and Don Gray, developed a pretty good relationship, and Minnie especially with Paula. Minnie would visit Paula right after they brought Lorelai home, and once in a while, you know, she would just talk to her about, like, life stuff. You know, just, I don't, older grandmotherly type neighbor stuff, I guess. But one time, while Paula was feeding the baby, Minnie recalls that Paula looks up to her and says, "Isn't she pretty? I guess that's what life really is all about." 12 days after Lorelai's birth, around 8:30 p.m., Robert leaves for work because he's still working his night shift at the paper products place, and he sees a man in a light blue Ford Falcon sitting near the pond on the Sims' property, and he tells them, like, "Look, buddy, you can't fish here." They had a pretty large area, like wooded area. There was a pond, like a lot of land. They rode ATVs all the time. That was kind of like, you know, they were very outdoorsy. So they had a pretty big area, and people would try to fish all the time on their property at this pond. So he tells them, like, "Hey, nope, can't fish here." Shortly before 10:30 p.m., Minnie and Don are getting ready for bed, and Paula runs over, and she's frantically yelling, "Let me in, let me in!" And she's begging the Grays for help, and she's repeating that they stole her baby. And Minnie and Don are like, "What in God's name are you talking about?" And they let Paula in, and they're trying to calm her down, and what they learn is horrifying, because Paula tells them that a masked man dressed all in black and brandishing a gun came into her home, told her to lay down on the basement floor for 10 minutes or else he was gonna kill her. Then he took Lorelai from her bassinet and they vanished. So Don calls the sheriff's office to report a kidnapping while Minnie's like trying to calm Paula down and get more information. And she ends up escorting Paula back to her home. But she realized like right away something was kind of odd. The Simses had a collie named Shadow and Minnie accidentally let Shadow out when they were going back inside the house. And Paula gets the dog back inside and she says, "I can't lose you too," according to Minnie. And Minnie's like, "Wait a second. I remember you telling me once before that Shadow always alerted to anyone outside." So she asks Paula, "Where was Shadow? Why didn't he bark?" And Paula's like, "I don't know. He must have been in a different room in the basement and he just didn't hear this intruder coming into our home." And Minnie was like, "Well, that's weird, but okay, whatever, everything's really hectic and it's just chaotic right now." But then she notices that in the bassinet where Lorelai had been taken by this man, lie her blanket, perfectly folded. So that stuck out to her and she, you know, told investigators later, like, that's just really odd because you would think if there was a man coming in here swiping this baby, your blanket's not going to be perfectly folded. Now, my mind is, what if she's laying on top of the blanket? Babies really aren't supposed to have blankets in their bassinet, but this was 1986, so, you know, I'm sure it wasn't thought of too much then, but I'm just trying to, like, be logical and reasonable here. Just because a blanket is folded perfectly doesn't mean that this story just automatically isn't true. You know, the baby could have been laying on top of the blanket, not covered up with the blanket. Anywho, Paula calls Robert at work and she tells him what's going on and he rushes home. But on the way, he stops at the home of friend Dave Highstand and he's like, "Listen, I'm hysterical. I can't even make the rest of the drive home. Can you drive me the rest of the way? It's just too much." So he's like, "Yep, I'll get you there." They pull up and authorities had arrived and they found a 4-inch L-shaped tear in the screen door leading into the home. And they're looking at it like, well, that's kind of perfectly cut and it's kind of weird. So like we immediately need to know everything that we can. Give us some identifying details about the intruder. What can you tell us? And nothing. Paula's like, I don't know. Can you describe the gun? I don't know. Can you describe his voice? I don't know. Are you able to provide any details to help us search for and identify this man? I don't know. Now, let's give the woman the benefit of the doubt that her 13-day-old child was, like, just taken from her home. I cannot imagine how I would react, what I would be able to say, what I could remember, what I could describe, you know. I don't know in those early moments how I would be. I would like to think that I could at least give one detail, but Paula was like, I know nothing. Don't know. Just know he had on black and he had a gun. Told me to lay down. That's it. So the media in this era, you know, just a news van shows up pretty quickly following the report, and everything is just kind of like, you know, it's a smaller town. I think a kidnapping on its own would be pretty like rock the community, but this was a 13-day-old baby. So yeah, this got a lot of exposure. Now, Jersey County Sheriff Frank Yocum described a really awkward exchange between Paula and Robert when Robert arrived at home and Paula is telling him that Lorelai is missing. Robert, like, doesn't move to hug Paula or comfort her in any way that society would, like, deem as normal. Paula's like, listen, I'm sorry for disappointing you. And Robert's like, you didn't. And she says, yes, I did. You were disappointed that Lorelai was a girl, and I've disappointed you in not stopping the person who took her. So Sheriff Yocum was like, what the hell? weird exchange, but Robert's a weird guy. These are two parents whose first child that is only 13 days old has been kidnapped. You know, we don't know how we would react. Maybe we would be weird too. On June 18th, 1986, law enforcement brought in scent tracking dogs. They conducted aerial view searches, and divers began searching the pond located behind the Sims' home. When searching the pond, they told the family, who was just kind of like standing on the porch watching, that maybe this would be a good time for Paula to go down and give her official statement. Like, maybe you guys might want to leave because we're searching a pond for your infant. And Paula's like, no, I don't want to do that because I want to be here when they bring her body up. And I would imagine that in the investigators' heads, it was like a record scratch sound. And she immediately corrected herself, like, oh, no, that's not what I meant. I just meant that I want to be here when they bring her up to the porch because I know she's still alive. Now, again, this is all coming from investigators interviewed for this book. You know, did Paula really say that? I don't know. But the investigator who heard this was like, oh, I gotta go write this down, and claims that he immediately went to his vehicle and jotted that down because it was pretty important statement. So nothing was recovered from the pond. When investigators questioned Paula a second time, they began asking questions about the state of the home. You know, everything seemed to be in its place and really neat and orderly and tidy. And they were like, why is that? If you had this man come in who cut your screen and, you know, told you to lay down, like, you would think there would be some type of something out of order. And Paula's like, I don't know. I don't know why there's no disarray of anything. I don't know why my dog didn't bark. You know, again, super strange because Minnie was like, yeah, the dog always barked. She said that. So investigators are asking, she's like, I don't know. The screen door was like really squeaky and loud when investigators were entering and exiting the home. So they were like, Paula, didn't you hear anything? Like, did you not hear this door? And she's like, nope. Didn't hear anything, me or the dog. So they did try to close the door quietly, like to just see if there was a chance that Paula couldn't hear anything when the intruder came in. But they concluded that it would have been almost impossible not to hear that door open. On June 24th, 1986, so about a week after Lorelai disappeared, searchers were still in the area around their home. They're still searching. You know, the pond has been searched. Like, they're not getting a lot of help from the Simmses. And so they're just kind of staying around this area. Now, one of the detectives said out loud, like, has anybody gone back to these woods yet? This wooded area? Like, have we gone in here yet? And Robert was nearby. And when he heard that, he said, oh, you don't want to go in there. There's that, it's crawling with poison ivy. So I don't recommend that you go in there for very long at all. So naturally, the detective was like, hey, take a dog and go in there right now. It was about 150 feet before the dog started to alert to human remains. Now, the bones of the remains were stained dark brown from bodily fluids that had been leaking during decomposition. So it was making it harder to find the bones between like twigs and leaves. And the man who was kind of taking over, I can't remember his title now or his name. I think it's Mark Johnsies, but could be completely wrong on the last name. So I apologize for that if he's still alive and somehow got wind of this podcast. But he has to like go through and painstakingly remove like blades of grass, one blade at a time. I mean, it was painstaking work. So they stop for the day and he goes back the next day, June 25th. And he ends up finding a total of about 50 bones that were scattered over 29 feet. It was along this hillside above a ravine. And the left arm and the left leg were missing. So he kind of concluded just by the way that they were scattered that it was probably a small animal, like a raccoon or something, that was feeding on the remains. And that's why they were scattered about so much. And so investigators are like, the baby wasn't even, there was no attempt to even conceal, like the baby's not buried. This is strange. So they start questioning Paula and Robert, and Paula is adamant, like, no, I didn't do anything. Robert didn't do anything. You know, absolutely not. Someone stole my baby. And it went on for so long. And, you know, I don't think any of us will know what it's like to be questioned by investigators until we actually are, for hours at a time. It's just, I always try to think about the source of information that I'm getting, who is explaining to me how the people are acting, I think is what I'm trying to say. So, the investigators are the ones saying that, hey, she's acting kind of weird because an innocent person probably would have already had an outburst by now. If we keep questioning an innocent person and implying that they had something to do with the disappearance or death of their baby, at some point they're going to snap and they're going to say, like, it wasn't fucking me. Just go find the person who did this. But Paula was never doing that. She wasn't protesting. She was pretty much saying, I don't want to say calm and cool, but there were no, outbursts. That's the only word I can think of that you would expect for a mother in this situation. Now, investigators said that Paula would cry, but it was an emotionless cry. The one time that she did seem genuine was after they told her, listen, we all know that Lorelai is dead. You know it. She's out there. Just help us find her. And right when they thought that they were on the brink of her like confessing something, Paula's mom knocked on the door. One of the sheriff's deputies who was out there with her went to the bathroom. And so Paula's mom was like, I'm going to take this opportunity. So she goes and knocks on the little door and she's like, that's enough. You've questioned my daughter enough. This is too much for her emotionally. Like, we're leaving. So they leave. Now, shortly after, Robert told the journalist who helped author the book, Charles Bosworth, that what hurt more than anything was not having the public support and understanding. And Robert said, quote, What's done is done until they find the guy. And in my note, I put 3 question marks because what? That struck me as so bizarre. Like, I don't give a shit what the public thinks. If my baby is missing, we all know, like, the media is going to decide whether you're innocent or guilty right away anyway. There's people like Nancy Grace. So it really doesn't matter to me what, like, I don't want to say it doesn't matter, but I would never say that what hurt more than having my infant newborn stolen from me is that the public didn't support me. It's unimaginable to me. So I just want to tell you guys that because it was really quite strange. So now, Robert and Paula both failed their polygraph tests. And I'm not going to continue to say this every episode, like polygraph, schmollygraph, okay? But it is important here because what happened next is Robert said in a press conference that both he and his wife passed their polygraphs. And they just really wished that investigators would focus on finding the real perpetrator of this crime because it wasn't them because they passed their polygraphs. And I think it was Sheriff Yoakum. I can't remember now, but they were like incensed, like who the balls on this guy. And I don't know if they made a public statement or not. It says something in the book. I can't remember now, but they were like, who the hell is this guy? So not a real good start between the family and law enforcement. On September 27th, 1986, Lorelei Marie Sims was buried in Woodland Hill Cemetery after her remains were positively identified using a genetic test. This was 1986. The only thing that they had from the remains was bone marrow. And what they did was they used blood samples from Paula and the remains to try and make a genetic match. In this report, it was a 97.2% certainty, and legally, only a 95% match is required for positive identification. So if you were going into court or something, they would only say, or they would only require 95%, but this was a 97.2, so they were quite certain that these were the remains of Lorelei. Her cause and mode of death was undetermined. They never could figure out exactly what happened. Now, in January of 1987, the Simses moved to a new home in Alton, Illinois. They had never returned to their Brighton home after Lorelei's disappearance. When June that year rolled around, Paula was reportedly devastated as Lorelei's first birthday approached and just the lost possibilities of celebrating, you know, all of those milestones with her daughter. Troy Sims, who again was Robert's father, said that he thought that the couple were looking forward to moving on, you know, a fresh start in a new place, just leaving the tragedy and their loss behind them. On February 1st, 1988, Randall Troy Sims was born, and the baby boy was healthy and thriving, and all seemed to be pretty quiet in the Sims' world, perhaps too quiet. Like, Robert built a privacy fence around the home after Randy was born, and neighbors recalled rarely ever seeing the family. Robert, of course, continued to work his night shift, but Paula and Randy, like, were never seen outside the home. They just lived very private lives, which, understandable. If the last time that you lived in thought that you killed your baby, fair enough. I don't want to sound too detached here from this story, but I refuse to open my door to, like, pick up my food delivery until I've confirmed that the driver is off my street. And I'm not under any scrutiny that I know of. So, like, privacy is fine, especially if your baby went missing and the whole community was like, we know you did it, but nobody can prove it. So, like, it's, I don't find that too weird that they weren't really ever outside, but that was like a theme in all the neighbors. That's what they wanted to say about them. On March 18th, 1989, the Sims welcomed Heather Lee Sims into the world. On April 29th, 1989, Robert returns home from his night shift, and he finds Paula unconscious on the kitchen floor. Randy was upstairs sleeping in his crib. You know, nothing else really seemed to be amiss, just an unconscious wife, and, that's worrisome. So he calls the police. Now, Bob Eichen was a pretty new cop. He had been on the job about 10 months, and dispatch sent him a call for a child abduction. It was about 11:27 p.m., and he pulls up to Washington Street, and he sees this man. He's outside on the porch, like, jumping up and down. He's got on overalls, no shirt, waving his arms, like, just very chaotic, frantic, disheveled looking. And this man, like, hops off the porch, runs up to the cruiser, and he's frantically saying, "We've got a set of roadblocks. They took my daughter. They took my other daughter." Does anybody want to guess who this man was? I'll wait. If you guessed Robert Sims, you would be correct, because I already told you that, because he called the cops. And that is where we are going to leave for part two. But don't worry. It will be here on Friday. I just, as I told you, had some technical issues, but it will be here Friday. And this is directed at the one person who said they were impatiently waiting. I don't mean that with any shade. I just want to comfort you and let you know that it will be here on Friday. A bit more polished and professional. Okay, love you, bye.